Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
It's Joe Benigno and Evan Roberts on The Fan.
Joe and Evan. On WFAN Sports Radio. If you want to be in the New York, no, gotta go to Joe and Evan. Evan and Joe. 66 on your AM dial, 101.9 FM. Joe and Evan on The Fan.
Okay, well, I am neither Joe nor Evan. I am Susan Waldman, and I will be here today from 2 to 5 with another original member of the WFAN team, and I don't think there's that many of them. There is me, there is Ed Coleman, there is Steve Summers, and there is my partner for the next 3 hours, the one and only voice of the New York Mets. Hello, Howie Rose.
Hello, Susan Waldman. This is fun.
Have we ever done a show together? In 34 years?
I'm sure we did. You know what I think we did? I think it was during the full season hockey lockout, which was in the winter of 04, 05.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're talking about 15, 16 years ago. But it was in a much more professional environment than where I'm sitting right now. Because you want to talk about the all-time jerry-rigged studio. I've got my iPad, which is locked into this app that we're using, surrounded by pillows to muffle some of the echo.
Let's
see, four books in a little box. So there's my studio.
Well, you sound sort of like you're in the bathroom. You know, that kind of, you know, this is why people sing in the shower, because of the big echo.
That's better than I usually sound, well, so thank you.
I'm actually on a machine. I think it's called a Comrex, and I'm sitting in my den, and I've got wires everywhere and all those kinds of things, and I do have a computer here, and this should be great. So we have decided that we're going to go around, and we're going to talk to our baseball friends for the next 3 hours, because there's a lot of them, and so we're going to start doing this. What have you been doing all this time, and how are you, Howie Rose?
I'm well, thankfully, and I hope you are as well. I've been fortunate in that I'm at home, which now for me is Florida during the off season. So effectively, I've been down here since October, and you know that's allowed me to take advantage of the weather and the ability to get outside and maybe do a few more things than I might have been able to do, certainly in March and most of April, had I been up north. But believe me, I, like most of the rest of us, am pining for baseball, with the caveat that it has to happen in a safe and efficient way, and hopefully we'll have a little bit of definition in this next week to 10 days, huh?
You know, I think so. I think in the next couple of weeks, and you know, and it's funny to me, and I feel the same way. People ask me, and you know, and I go, my mood changes from minute to minute. I'm fine now because I'm doing something and I can think about, you know, our life. Somebody says, how much do you miss baseball? And my response is always, I miss my life. And baseball was a part of that. And everything that we are and the people that we know and the things that we do have been given to us because of our association with baseball, I think. And that's what I miss. And that's what, and, you know, and the caveat, you say it's a caveat. I'm sorry. I'm sitting here in the middle of New York. I'm not in the middle of New York City. We will talk to Dave Sims in the next hour, the voice of the Seattle Mariners and also another member of WFAN reunion staff. And he is in the middle of the city. He's on, you know, he lives there. So it's a whole other thing when you're in the middle of it. And I don't know. I'm a positive person by nature, but I'm also a realist, and I look at everything that that has to happen and what has to go right. And boy, I hope that that they've got it all together and that it doesn't take things away from anybody else, which I think is a very important part of this.
And full disclosure, and I think most of our listeners know this anyway, but Susan and I and everyone on our Mets On Air broadcast team, with the exception of young Wayne Randazzo, and John, your partner, John Sterling, and some on the Yankee side, are in a more vulnerable age range right now than had we been in our 20s or 30s. And so our sensibilities, from a very selfish standpoint, are a little bit more measured, at the very least, when it comes to our desire to have baseball back. Of course, we all want it back. But the health concerns that involve really all of us who present baseball to the public on one level or another, you know, may be varied based on age and certain medical pre-existing conditions. We all want the same thing. But I think we have different levels of trepidation, and those of us within the broadcast community, in fact, most of those who we will talk to today, are in that age range as well. So it's a complicated issue, and I just hope that, you know, people who might not be thinking quite along those lines can understand the trepidation that certain, if not most, of us have.
Yeah, and that is something that is, it's very real. It's very real. And I know that so many people that are not of our age, I mean, they're saying elderly. I didn't know I was elderly. I've never heard myself described that way.
I could have told you that.
Well, no, but you never would have. I mean, you never would have said that. But here's the thing is that I've never heard myself described at that. But, you know, when you hear television telling you that you're over the age of 60, you're old, you're elderly, which means that, I mean, I'm very healthy. You're very healthy. I don't have any pre-existing conditions. My pre-existing condition is that I'm not 40 anymore. And that's very scary for us, because, you know, I have a lot of friends who have had this. It's, it hit the Broadway community very hard. It went through shows before they could shut down. And this is not staying home with a flu, by the way. This is a nasty thing, and this is not something that you'd want. By the way, before we go to our first guest, I did see something on Twitter. Patrick Ewing Jr. has just posted that his dad, one of the dearest people I've ever met, Patrick Ewing, is out of the hospital. And he's home and resting. Yeah, he said it was serious, but it's not serious enough for him to stay in the hospital. So that's another another breathe a sigh of relief. Patrick Ewing is home and he's going to do everything, but his son just put that up. Now, one of our dearest friends and has connections to both of us in so many ways. Right now, the voice of the Baltimore Orioles out in California, God's country. Hello, Gary Thorne. It's Susan and Howie. How are you?
I guess I'm elderly then.
Yeah, join the crowd, pal.
Yeah, you.
Gee, I hope we didn't wake you up. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Nobody wakes me up.
Well, I'm up at 6 with the dog. So, and you're out in California, and you're elderly, and I'm elderly, and we're all elderly. And how have you been passing this time? I gather you and the girls are well, and how have you been passing this time?
I'm really wondering how I ever did anything else. Seemingly, every day goes flying by, and I can't believe it. We've done a lot of stuff outside. We're able to get out here. We're in the country setting. So we bike and walk and hike and all that kind of good stuff. And I've got a younger daughter who's in school, so she's doing the online schooling thing. So during the week, that usually takes up a half a day. I'm trying to figure out how to do 3/4 plus 2/8.
I hope you're not the teacher.
Wait a minute. Can't you just tell her that you have a law degree, so you don't need to do this kind of stuff?
So leave me alone.
Hey, Susan, you know what?
It's really flown by. We're doing stuff, and, thank God we've been safe and we're healthy and enjoying, I'm enjoying being home.
Well, you know, one of the many reasons that we always like to check in with you is, I think, very topical in that if and when we do get back to broadcasting baseball this year, at least from the beginning, if not for the entirety of whatever season we get, there will not be fans in the stands. And you are one of the very, very few people on earth who can relate to that, having done a game at Camden Yards when there was civil unrest in Baltimore several years ago, where for that one day, fans were not permitted to the game. So when you think back, what kind of a learning experience was that that you might be able to put to work this year if everything transpires the way it sounds like it might?
Yeah, well, it was very strange, obviously, in kind of a different situation because there was so much tension surrounding the game. I mean, they called off two games because of the civil unrest in the city, and whether they were going to play that third game or not was very much up in the air till the last minute, and there was still concerns about there being some civil disobedience going on or gatherings in the city, and with the ballpark having a game there create a focal point where there'd be more trouble, or would it really be something that would relax some of the tension? All that went into it. But as far as broadcasting the game itself, you just had to get used to no noise, and you realized how important it is to have that background of fans is to an athletic event. And because doing it silently was, you stopped talking and there was nothing. I mean, it was just nothing. And there's been concern. Other broadcasters have asked me, well, you know, you're announcing the game, the booth's open, the window's open, and everybody's hearing you on the field, which is true. I mean, Adam Jones came out of the dugout at one point, told me to pipe down, smiling, laughing at me. Zach Britton said he was on the mound and he could hear me. Now Britton's getting ready for the delivery, and he said, can I just mute you for a minute? And I said, no, you can't. And that kind of thing did go on, but I think as the game got going, after the first couple of innings, you just kind of fell into a rhythm, and you kind of forgot about it. You do the game the way you normally do a game, and the players, even though they could hear you and could hear each other, they toned it down because stuff in the dugout, one dugout could be heard in the other, and you just went through the game. The one thing I will say about that game is that when you're playing in front of no fans, the players played. It was throw the ball, hit the ball, catch the ball. If I remember right, the game was just over 2 hours long. We were back to old-time baseball.
Giddy up.
There wasn't any fooling around, stepping out of the batter's box and taking 40 seconds to throw a pitch or something. I mean, they just played. Whether that would carry over when you're doing a number of games in an empty ballpark, I don't know, but I think it makes a real difference.
You know, it's funny that you said that, and Gary's being nice. Gary said... said that, you know, some people have asked him. We had a Zoom call, Howie. We had a Zoom call of all us elderly announcers in the American League. There are 22 of us, and that didn't include John Sterling because he has a flip phone and couldn't do it. And another announcer who's afraid of Zoom, and he wouldn't do it. But we had it, and one announcer, and he will remain nameless, came up and said, we're talking about health concerns and what's bothering us. And he said, you know, I've got a really loud voice, and I'm really worried I'm going to be in this empty stadium. And I said, this is what you're worried about? We're trying to stay healthy and not die? And you're worried because someone's going to think you're too loud? And Gary's laughing. I could see Gary trying to be very polite, as he always is, sitting on the Zoom call, just sort of chuckling to himself. I would think, though, you know, that eventually everyone would get used to it, and you just know that. But you could say something like, you know, you could yell to... Who is your shortstop anyway, Gary? I don't even
know. Don't know this year. I haven't had time to find out.
Wait, is Iglesias on that team?
It ain't Mike
Iglesias
Bullock.
Is going to play short, yes.
Okay. I didn't even know Jose Iglesias was on that team. So, you could say, you know, move over, Jose, a little bit, and he could hear you if you saw something like you guys did in the booth.
What's interesting? Susan, that's interesting because Gary, you could. I don't know that you necessarily would have done this before Adam Jones told you to pipe down, but if you're looking And you're doing TV. I assume that day I'd mm-hmm. been doing radio, as would Susan, but we'd have a monitor, which I would assume would have the center field camera feed.
Right.
So if I'm looking at it from the center field camera, I mean, I can almost unknowingly give location away, right? I might just say, as I normally would, well, so-and-so, you know, whoever's catching, he's set up inside here, and I can see the guy in the hitter's tipping his helmet to me. Thank you very much.
Who needs these garbage cans? We don't need garbage cans. We don't need to pet. We got us.
Oh, now we're going to be the ones investigated. Yeah, you could do that. I mean, that could,
it was inevitable.
That could actually happen, but I have a feeling, I mean, as a lot of players say about all this cheating stuff, and I don't diminish what went on, but a lot of players say, I don't want to know. Don't tell me. I'm not listening to this stuff. I get the signal from second base. The guy's going to throw me a curveball. I lean in and I take one in the ribs on a heater. A lot of guys just don't want anything to do with that. So if they won't listen to one another, they're probably not going to listen to us about location and the pitch that's coming.
Yeah, but it'll confuse.
I'm not giving them pitch. I'll give them location, but it stops there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it'll confuse the heck out of the other team, though, won't it?
It will do that. Right. It will do that.
See, Gary, so we have already missed our trip to Prime Rib. Gary and John and I, Howie, go to our favorite restaurant in the league. It happens to be in Baltimore. And we were going to open the season in Baltimore. And that's really – and we would have played, what, 7 games with you already?
Yeah.
And you could have called more Gleyber Torres home runs.
Is he still playing?
That's right.
Howie, did you ever see that when Gary?
Yes, I have seen the clip. Yeah.
Oh God,
he's killing you guys, right? But do you know somebody tipped me off, or I saw the date earlier today? Do you remember, Mr. Thorne, a particular hockey game that we broadcast 26 years ago tonight?
Probably not. What was it?
If I said Mark Messier, guaranteed. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, my God. Was it his hat trick night? Was this night of that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, was that something else, huh?
Yeah, that was that was unbelievable. Talk about a player rising up to the occasion and telling people he was going to do it before the game had even started. Yeah, that was that year was just so tremendous. The games in the playoffs were so unbelievable, and the ferocity of that game and what he did. It's one of the I've always thought that's one of the great moments in sports ever. I mean, that's the Kirk Gibson home run kind of thing is what Messier pulled off in that one.
Now, how are you, Gary? You started really as a hockey announcer, right? You were doing this a long time ago.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I started as a junior in high school, and I did football primarily, high school football, and basketball is where I really started doing games in the local station back in Maine. And then baseball was really the last sport that I did at a professional level, because I did hockey for the University of Maine while I was practicing law in Maine as an avocation, and did games for them for a number of years. And then we had our AAA team, and I did games. I was one of the owners, limited partners. And I did games for our AAA team, and then I moved on to the Mets. So the baseball actually came last as far as sports that I broadcast, and hockey was kind of the third one after high school basketball and football.
When you were with the Mets, greatest memories of the Mets, I've always wanted to ask you this. We've always talked about other things at our dinners.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not much is going to beat 86 and the whole playoff, that playoff series against Houston, which kind of gets lost in the shuffle of the Red Sox World Series and everything that happened there. But it was a tremendous playoff year. I mean, those games in Houston against Houston were unbelievable games. And then the series against the Red Sox. But I remember the people. Most of all, my time with the Mets is about the people. I mean, Bob Murphy, number one. Murph and I worked together in the booth and became so close and such really good friends. Somebody who I genuinely miss every day, think about him. And with Ralph and Timmy and Tom Seaver, I mean, the people I got to work with there. Frank Cashin, who I had the greatest respect for and had a great friendship with, was the GM at the time. And Al Harrison, who was his assistant, who really was one of the prime movers in getting me the job with the Mets initially. I mean, I think about those people. They were just wonderful people. I've always said for my professional career in baseball broadcasting, the only problem was I started at the top and there wasn't anywhere else to go. I mean, I worked for this great organization in New York, great front office, open, fun, treated you as a family. The second year I'm doing the games, we end up they end up winning a World Series. I mean, where do you go from there? I mean, you can't get much better than the whole scenario of what was going on with the Mets at that time. And I loved it. And those are the people along with that great 86 season that I remember the most.
Well, we miss you, and I'm happy that you're doing well out there. A bike ride today, a hike. What do you got today to kill
time? Yeah, we'll do both today. It's really warming up, so we're going to take the bikes out and we'll do a little we'll do a good walk and take the dog out as I do every day for the walk, and it'll be great. I mean, I really am enjoying staying with the family, and just stay healthy, folks. Stay healthy. Put the mask on. It matters. Keep the distance. It matters. Yeah. It's not about just for you. You're doing that for others to try and protect people around you. So I just hope people will take that seriously so we can get through this.
Me too. Tell Kali I need some more lavender sachets, okay?
I will tell her that. She's standing right here.
Okay, tell Kali I need some more. Okay, Gary's got the most adorable. What is Kali now, 10, 9, 10?
She's 10.
And yep. She's 10, and she grows lavender, and she makes these little lavender sachets, and I had them all over the house, and now I need some more, okay?
I will tell her that. I will put her back to work to help support her father.
All right.
You're
well,
a slave driver, Thorne.
Well,
that's right. That's what I am, Howie. Slave driver.
Well, maybe we'll go to prime rib next year, because it obviously isn't going to be this year.
Let's hope. Let's hope. All right.
All right,
you guys.
Gary.
Really
be well. Stay well. Thank you.
Take care.
Right. Thanks, Susie.
Okay, but you know, I'd forgotten Howie that he was there that early in 95 and 96. And I remember, you know, he talks about the people, and that's what that is. When we were on this Zoom call, that's who I miss, all those announcers, because as you know, you do this long enough and there's only a few of us. There really aren't a lot of us. And you really do become like brothers or brothers and sisters in that. And that's who I met, those 20 people on Zoom trying to figure out how to use the microphone and how to, you know, unmute the button. Yeah, push the thing on the right. And that's what you miss about this whole thing. Let me give out the phone number here.
Yeah.
877-337-6666, and we'll take your phone calls. And a little inside radio. Should we take a break here, Paul? Yes, he said. Okay. Susan Waldman along with Howie
Works
Rose.
For me.
877-337-6666. I'm in Westchester. Howie's in Florida. And down in the studio is our friend Paul Rosenberg. We'll be right back.
The Sports Leader, Sports Radio 101.9 FM. The Fan. And Sports Radio 66 WFAN.
And it's 2:41 here on The Fan on this Memorial Day. I hope you're all enjoying this day. Susan Waldman along with Howie Rose. And as we are saying, we're just going around baseball and we're talking to our friends that we miss dearly. And this guy who I have known for a very long time, Howie's known him even longer, as he wrote a book called The Men and Moments That Made the New York Yankees the Big 50. It's just a delightful, delightful book. And of course, he writes now for the New York Post. But for many years, he wrote for the Daily News, and John Sterling used to refer to him as our buddy Buddy. So, hi, Peter Buddy. How are you?
Hi, Susan. Hi, Howie. Hope you guys are doing well. I have to say,
hey,
before
Peter.
We start, hey, guys, before we start, I have to say I'm thrilled to be kind of like the opening act for the Leave It to Beaver segment.
Aren't you excited?
Like Tessie O'Shea.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking about Lumpy and Whitey and all the guys.
Well, that's exactly
Tessie
right.
O'Shea, I think. She was on before the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Yes.
You know, the first time the Beatles. Nobody wanted to hear from Tessie O'Shea. They just wanted to hear from the Beatles. But well, I think there's a much more enthusiastic clamoring to hear from Peter than there was to hear Tessie O'Shea.
I think everybody wants to hear from Peter Boddy. And, you know, I got a couple of questions for you. Be interesting. And you start with the, you know, obviously the Bambino and Lou Gehrig and the Boss. How did you decide which 50 you were using?
Yeah, I mean, that was the most daunting challenge to narrow the Yankees down to 50 men and moments that made the franchise. Obviously, 27 championships and so many Hall of Famers and, you know, perfect games and Roger Maris with 61 homers and, you know, Reggie's three homers in the World. So many great moments in addition to just the World Series victories. So what I did was I made a list of probably 80 to 100 men and moments that I thought merited their own chapters, and then I started whittling it down from there. What I decided to do, ultimately, the only way I could make it work was to put all of Babe Ruth's moments into one chapter, put all of, say, Jeter's moments into one chapter, and so on, and had to combine some of the World Series years into one chapter. Like, for example, the 49 to 53 five-peat champions. I made that one chapter because I couldn't do a separate chapter on every one of them. But Susan, you mentioned having George Steinbrenner as number three. I decided to break up the Mount Rushmore and put George right behind Ruth and Gehrig and ahead of DiMaggio and Mantle, just because I felt like, I mean, obviously everybody knows that those are the four biggest iconic names in Yankee history. But for me, George was so important for so long, you know, 40 years of Yankee history. He was really the face of the franchise. So I wanted to make that designation to get him high up into the top five. So I made him number three. I thought maybe it would spark a little debate as well. But yeah, I felt like George was so important to the franchise for so long that I wanted to make the distinction of having him up at number three behind Ruth and Gehrig as the top two.
And Peter, it's not just, you know, what George did and stuff. You've got stories there. I never knew about that Red Sox media game with your son coaching first base. And I never knew about the pretzels in the desk. I mean, these are iconic stories. Tell these stories. This is great. This is great stuff.
It's really hilarious stuff. I mean, everybody that I spoke to, I asked them for like what their favorite George Steinbrenner story was. And there were some that I could have gone on and on for pages telling more anecdotes. Some of them were really funny. Like you mentioned, I wanted to interject into certain chapters some of my own experiences, and, you know, because let's face it, you're not going to break a whole lot of new ground when it comes to some of these iconic Yankee figures. My son, every year the Yankees media plays against the Boston media, both at Yankee Stadium and at Fenway, what we like to think is baseball, but it's, you know, it might be a little less. It might not be exactly how Abner Doubleday drew it up. But, so one year my son, he was probably 8 years old, maybe nine. He was coaching first base. We were down by a run in the last inning. And George Rose, who was the interpreter for Hideki Arabu, was playing for our side. And he got picked off first base. My son didn't yell back in time. And he got picked off first base, and that ended the game. So a couple of days later, George had called me back for some other reason. I had called his office to interview him about something obviously unrelated to the media game. But somehow, in some way, George found out about it. And his first quote to me when we started the conversation was, I heard about your son. You know, if he's not ready to be on that field, he can't be on the field. And, you know, so I said to my son, you know, like, hey, you'll always have that. George Steinbrenner called you out in a moment, you know, one of those moments. But, yeah, there's a lot of fun stories. Susan, did you know the story about Dave Rigetti and the lie detector test?
No, I never knew that one either. I didn't know the pretzels in the desk, and I didn't know the lie detector test.
Yeah, well, real quick.
Give me this one, Peter. I don't know anything about this one.
So real quick, the pretzels in the desk was Buster Olney was interviewing George Steinbrenner in his office, and somebody from the concessions company knocked and excused himself, came into the office and said, Mr. Steinbrenner, you wanted to see me. And it was like a scene right out of Seinfeld. George pulls a pretzel out of his desk drawer and says to the guy, look at this pretzel. There's not enough salt on this pretzel. We need to have more salt on these pretzels. So it was like I said, it was something like Larry David would have dreamed up on Seinfeld. The Rigetti thing, Rigetti, in his first year as closer in, I guess it was 85, suffered an injury on his hand. He cut his hand open, and he did it in the bullpen. You know, before the game, he had been watching WWE wrestling, and he was out there with a couple of his teammates, and he was kind of explaining what happened in the wrestling match that he was watching between Sergeant Slaughter and the Iron Sheik. And he hit his hand on this metal thing above his head, up against the wall, and he sliced his hand open. And so George was furious, obviously. Rigetti told him the story. He didn't believe him. George didn't believe him. So he made everybody who was out there, Jerry McNerney and, you know, a couple of the players that were there, he made them all take lie detector tests. And, McNerney actually got demoted to the minors. He was the bullpen coach at the time, and he ended up getting demoted to the minors because George didn't believe the lie detector test that everybody, that the story that they told. All he heard was, as Rigetti tells it, all he heard was that Rigetti and somebody else were wrestling, when in actuality he was just kind of explaining a wrestling match that he was watching, and that's how he cut his hand. But I found the lie detector story to be, you know, apropos of George's personality in those days. I had never heard that story before, and Rigetti said he had never actually told the story in detail before. So, you know, it was fun to have a couple of anecdotes that hadn't been reported previously.
You know, there was a figure in Yankees' fairly recent history that anybody who knew him just loved, and I had the pleasure of knowing him, I guess, going back to even the 1970s when he was a player for the Yankees. And that was Gene Michael, who had so much to do with kind of rejuvenating things when George had been suspended. Does Stick figure into your book anywhere at all?
He did.
Because,
no,
I mean, he had such an imprint and an impact.
Stick. I just felt like he was so important to the construction of that 90s dynasty. You know, while George was on suspension, you know, retooled that team. He brought in players like Boggs and Jimmy Key and traded for Paul O'Neill and those veteran guys that kind of set the stage before the core four and the homegrown guys arrived. But, you know, Stick also made the decision to hold on to Bernie Williams while, you know, in the 80s, there was the litany of prospects that got traded away. We all know the list: Rio, Drabeck, Jay Buhner, so on and so on.
Ken Phelps, had to have Ken Phelps.
Exactly. And that's a chapter two. We can get to that in a few minutes. But but Bernie was kind of the test case for the young guys in the organization, for the franchise to be patient with players like him, and they really kind of let him grow. I have in my chapter on Bernie, I put in there that I believe that he should be every bit on the level of the core four. Not to take anything away from those guys, but I feel like Bernie gets the short end of the stick when it comes to those. When it comes to, you know, the core four, I know he was there before them and left before them. But for me, Bernie is every bit as integral of those championship teams as anybody. And, you know, Stick is the guy that put that team together. And I definitely think that Stick deserved a chapter for, you know, for everything that he did, whether it was kind of fending off George when George came back, resisting trading, you know, players like Mariano Rivera. So obviously he meant so much to those 90s teams, and he definitely deserves his place in that, in, you know, on that list.
Howie, I want to read you the first sentence of the chapter on Stick Michael, because it's so perfect. And this is what Peter wrote to start this chapter. You know how so many of the Marvel Universe or DC Comics movies have an origin story? We'll call this the origin story for the superheroes known as the Yankees 1990s dynasty, because that's what it was. I've always said that Stick Michael brought four people in the door: Paul O'Neill, Wade Boggs, Jimmy Key, and Mike Stanley. And those four were brought in to change the culture in that clubhouse, along with Buck Showalter. And they did. And I was so glad that you had this chapter on him, because he was the one guy that was through it all. People were fired. People went in. People went out. Stick was always there. He was always in George's office, and he was always the one that was there through all all of it in whatever capacity he had, and was still there till, you know, till the day he died. He was still part of the Yankees family, and I thought that what you said, Peter, about him in the beginning, it's perfect. That is the origin story for the dynasty. It was Stick and, of course, Buck. And I remember Stick telling me the story of how he lied to George about nobody wanted Bernie. I mean, he told him to trade him. Remember that Texas day? And he told him to trade him. And Stick called everybody and asked about everybody on the team. And see, boss, nobody wanted him. I told you, nobody wanted him. And that was, it was just so amazing. George Costanza gets a chapter.
He does. And when as I was making my lists in the beginning, I told myself that I wanted, this was kind of going to be my labor of love chapter. Some people who know me well said to me, you only wrote this book, right? So you could write this one chapter on George Costanza and Seinfeld. And I was like, I mean, that's probably partially true. When I set out to do it, I didn't know that I was going to get Larry David on the phone, but I ended up speaking to him for quite a while, and he couldn't have been more insightful and more gracious and really funny. And some of the stories that he tells of having to get George's approval, you know, to use the Yankee brand and to use his likeness, and then, you know, from there they just took it to the nth extreme, to make a caricature of George. And you know, George, even to his credit, he didn't know much about the show when they asked him if they could do it, and his grandchildren kind of prodded him into doing it. They were fans of Seinfeld, and they told him, you know, you have to do this. And George was actually quoted in a story in the late 90s, saying that to his grandchildren, it was cooler that he was a character on Seinfeld than it was that he owned the Yankees. And, you know, Larry tells some great stories about, even, you know, George Steinbrenner actually flew out to LA and filmed a couple of scenes with Julia Louis-Dreyfus that ended up on the cutting room floor. Jerry and
it's
Larry.
It's on YouTube, by the way. I've seen the scenes.
Yeah.
They're on YouTube if anybody wants to watch
them. You can find them.
I do.
For them. George was going to accompany Julia Louis-Dreyfus' character, Elaine, to George Costanza's wedding. And Larry and Jerry just didn't think it worked, but they had to actually tell George that he was cut from the show after flying all the way out there. So they said he actually handled it pretty well. Anybody who watches the show knows the Yankees and George's impact on the George Costanza character and on the series. There was appearances by Bernie and by Derek Jeter and by Paul O'Neill, Danny Tartable, Buck Showalter is in the show. But the Steinbrenner caricature really is what makes it. And you mentioned Jay Buhner, Ken Phelps before Howie. Obviously, that is the classic scene. And Jerry Stiller just passed away earlier this month, and he was great as Frank Costanza. And, you know, he interjects while George Steinbrenner is at the Costanza's house, telling them that their son had passed away erroneously. Jerry Stiller's Frank Costanza interjects, what the hell did you trade Jay Buhner for? You know, he's got a rocket for an arm, da, da, da. And then he leaves this great message on Jerry Seinfeld's answering machine. Jerry, it's Frank Costanza. Mr. Steinbrenner's here. George is dead. Call me back. So it was such an important part of that era of Yankee history. And guys like O'Neill and Bernie talk about it like really kind of reverentially, like Bernie and O'Neill both said to me, like, they get as many people say to them that they love their appearance on Seinfeld as say to them about a remembrance of a game or things like that. So, you know, it really was a big part of those 90s era Yankee teams. And the fact that,
you know,
it lives forever. You can watch it. I mean, there's five episodes on every day. You can find it on TV, and there's Yankee Stadium, and there's George Costanza dragging the World Series championship trophy behind his car.
Yes, that's my favorite scene. I love that.
Yeah,
real quickly, Peter, you mentioned Paul O'Neill again, and that's where I get back to Stick. And Susan, you know this as well as anybody. You know, Paul O'Neill was Gene Michaels' Lou Piniella, if that makes sense. And Stick, that's what I loved about his eye for talent, mm-hmm. his ability to evaluate not only the raw abilities of a player, but the way he would fit into the fabric of a clubhouse and help create the chemistry of a group was unmatched by probably any other baseball talent evaluator I ever knew.
Absolutely, and O'Neill was the perfect fit for Yankee Stadium and for that mm-hmm. team, and at that time. And George Steinbrenner labeled him the Warrior, and O'Neill talks about in the book, you know, how at first he wasn't sure how to react to it, but you know, coming from George Steinbrenner, he always kind of wore it as a badge of honor. And Paul talks about, you know, playing the 1999 clinching game in the World Series the same day that his dad passed away, and
yep.
what an emotional night that was after they win the World Series against the Braves. And it was such an emotional year. Joe Torre had left with cancer. Don Zimmer had taken over. Strawberry was coming back from cancer that year. Scott Brosius and Luis Soho lost their dads that year as well. So it was a real 99 was a real different year than 98. But yeah, O'Neill talks about that in the book, and he talks about the night in the two nights in 2001 where they came back in the ninth innings with the home runs by Tino and Brosius. But people forget that O'Neill was retiring that year too. And that last game, you know, they went on to lose that World Series in Arizona. But that last game, with the fans chanting O'Neill's name, didn't know what to do, how to react to it. And say, he says even now it gives him goosebumps thinking about that. New York kind of, you know, accepted him and loved him that way, that they would do that, even though the Yankees, they hadn't even won that World Series, but the fans knew that was going to be his last home game. And that was a really emotional time. And that was kind of the emotional, hard on his sleeve player that O'Neill was. You know, we talk all about the core four and the pitching staff and Joe Torre, but guys like O'Neill were kind of the glue of those late 90s championship teams. And as Susan, as you mentioned, you know, him and Boggs and Key and Mike Stanley, those guys, along with Buck, really set the stage for those championships that came afterward.
The book is called The Men and Moments That Made the New York Yankees the Big 50, and Peter Boddy is the author. It's by Triumph Books. It's really good. I said it's like eating bonbons. I just kept reading and reading and reading and reading. It's so much fun, and you did such a great, great job, Peter. Thank you so much. I hope we get to see you somewhere down
great
the road.
Great talking to you, Pete.
Yeah, absolutely. Howie, I'm bummed that we didn't get to talk any hockey, but thanks for
well,
thanks
let me
for
just
having
direct
me and,
your listeners. Yep, read Fish Sticks too.
There you go. That was nice. That's also out there too. That was my first book with Alan Hahn. But thank you both for having me, and look forward to seeing you hopefully at a ballpark at some point in the near future.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Peter.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.